On the program today, a poison pill. What is it, and does it actually work? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Reis, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, April 15th. Good to have you with us. Congrats on making it to Friday. It has been a big economic week. We got a lot of numbers to sift through. Inflation, retail sales, unemployment, just to name a few. And to help get me through it and look back on the week that was, I've got Anna Swanson from the New York Times and Sudeep Reddy with Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Rima.
Hey, Rima.
All right, so we got new data this week that told us, perhaps not so surprisingly, that inflation is still high. It hit 8.5% last month, which is the fastest pace in more than 40 years. But I guess what is surprising is that a lot of economists, they responded optimistically, saying, oh, we're actually in peak inflation. Anna, what do you make of that? Are you buying this peak inflation narrative?
Well, I think there are a lot of good reasons this might be the peak. Mm-hmm. So we did see some slowing in inflation for goods last month. And some of that may be that we're seeing companies build back inventories that were really stretched earlier in the pandemic. And you also have a very important base effect where because prices began to rise last spring, the year-on-year increase going forward won't look as high. Mm. And of course, at some point, the Fed's interest rate increases are going to slow demand. But it's a really hard call. At this point, you know, people still have a lot of pent up savings from the pandemic, and there are definitely more supply side pressures in the pipeline. About 370 million people in China were locked down earlier this week, mm-hmm. And that could affect a lot of supply chains and add to inflationary pressures there. So basically, a lot of people have called peak inflation over and over again for months and been wrong repeatedly. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be one of those people. I would say probably, but let's wait and see. Even if we have hit peak, we may not see a really rapid retreat. We may see some of those forces keeping inflation relatively high for longer. Mm.
Yeah, I'm getting a bit of deja vu when inflation started ramping up last year and it was so-called transitory, which we know that's not the case.
Right.
Sudeep, what's your take on all of this?
You know, I think I might have been one of the people 6 months ago hoping that we were actually hitting peak inflation back then. Mm-hmm. And we clearly did not. I just had the good fortune to not say it out loud. But I did wonder it at the time. So much of this really depends on oil prices. The headline inflation that includes food prices and oil prices. Obviously, oil prices are depending a lot on Russia and whether there's going to be an oil embargo from Europe on Russia. Mm-hmm. That will then drive a whole other wave of inflation panic. And all of this happening is enough of a problem at the headline inflation level. Then under the surface, there's some things happening that are probably worrying central bankers right now. A lot of the goods-driven inflation, like used cars and consumer electronics, has actually moderated. But mm-hmm. then there are signs of services inflation rising, which is not surprising given wages going up, given how tight the labor market is. And so there are a lot of cross currents here that made me surprised so many economists were willing to use the language of peak inflation. But I guess you can say that a lot of economists don't mind being wrong in the end if they can sound good in the moment.
Totally. Yeah, they're just trying to be optimistic too. Anna, you mentioned supply chain headaches. You talked about, you know, China, what's happening there, the logistical backup because of COVID lockdowns. Also, there's the new border policy from Texas to inspect trucks from Mexico, which has shut down some trade bridges. Thinking about supply chain, you wrote a really great piece in the New York Times about how this problem of supply chains will likely not go away even after the pandemic. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, of course. So I thought this was interesting. In a report this week, the White House argued that supply chain issues are likely to outlast our current moment. And one of the reasons they highlighted is because of climate change. So the number of billion-dollar natural disasters that the United States is experiencing each year has actually risen very significantly in the last decade. And climate change also means that people are more attuned to some of the hidden costs of whizzing all these parts and components all around the world. So, for example, once you price in the carbon costs from shipping, your cheap product from China might not be so cheap anymore. Mm. So basically, once we take the carbon cost of moving a steel container halfway around the world into account, what will global supply chains end up looking like? So the White House suggests that there may be some you know, more fragility in supply chains going forward that outlast just the pandemic and the war in Ukraine, which have certainly put a lot of pressure on supply chains.
Great. Sudeep, you cover politics. Politically, what can the administration do on supply chains?
You know, they can keep pushing to find ways to deal with some of these. Really, there's so many obscure problems. There are obvious problems that we're hearing about with used cars, with electronics, with furniture. There are so many obscure problems that they're going to have to work on getting the minerals that go into batteries that will go into vehicles, for getting the little parts that none of us has ever thought about that are now going to be gumming up the entire system. There are policy responses to deal with some of those things. In some cases, it means setting up different supply chains, onshoring some of these things, setting up incentive systems, working through diplomacy to make some of it happen. They can work through it, but it's not going to be in a timeline that actually makes a difference for politics, which is the problem that they have right now.
Right. All right. We have about a minute. I want to ask y'all are part of the American economy, right? How do you square all this? Because taking a step back, our economy is in a pretty unusual spot, right? We've got record inflation. And on the other hand, we've got near record unemployment. How do you all feel about the economy? Anna, you can go first.
So I feel like the economy is still doing better than it feels to a lot of people. So there's plenty of potentially alarming headlines for econ reporters that, you know, you brought up, you know, the Fed raising rates, the war in Ukraine affecting commodities and energy and supply chain issues and lockdowns in China, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, people still have a lot of pent up savings. There were state unemployment rates out today showing that 17 states are at or tied with the lowest unemployment rate they've ever had. So, I think it's a very mixed picture. And the key question is what happens next with the Fed and with supply chains and inflationary pressures.
Totally. Sudeep, 15 seconds.
Look, I'm not losing sleep over the inverted yield curve like some people might be. I know everyone's doing that. But we're all students of history, and we know that we're probably due for some trouble in the next year or two, given all these cross currents you're talking about. But for now, you know, we should just work hard to enjoy the time, because they're good things that are happening in the economy. And maybe it's a lesson of the pandemic era that we should actually enjoy the good parts when we see them, without always worrying about the bad parts that are coming around the corner.
Ah, love that optimism. Sudeep Reddy is with Politico. Anna Swanson is with the New York Times. Thank you, you two.
Thanks, Rima.
Today is Good Friday, so no trading, but we'll have a different set of numbers for you coming up. Now on to the corporate news of the day. I've got two words for you. Poison pill. That is corporate speak for Twitter's counterattack against Elon Musk, a defense move, if you will, to fend off a $43 billion bid from the Tesla and SpaceX CEO. The board voted with zero opposition to approve a measure that would dilute Musk's stake in the social media company. So-called poison pills are designed to prevent hostile takeovers. Here's Marketplace's Andy Euler to explain more.
Twitter's poison pill is designed to kick in when any shareholder acquires at least 15% of its outstanding stock without the board's okay. And that's pretty typical of these measures, says Donna Hittrich. She's director of the private equity program at Columbia Business School.
What the pill provides is that everybody, except the triggering person or the bad shareholder, whoever hit that threshold level, will get to buy additional shares of the company at a discount.
And what that means is that the ownership percentage of the shareholder who's trying to take over the company would be way less. 10 years ago, Netflix used a poison pill to fend off Carl Icahn. In 2018, the board of Papa John's implemented one to limit the control of its founder.
The only way to get around the poison pill is to run what we call a proxy contest, which is a contest to unseat the directors.
That's Stephen Davidoff Solomon. He's a law professor at UC Berkeley. He says the poison pill was popular in the 80s and through the mid-90s. It was seen as a cheap insurance policy for a company's board. But then, Evan Raleigh at the University of Connecticut says there was a backlash. Poison pills started to look like companies' board members were just trying to protect their jobs.
those people are may not be the best representatives of the shareholders more broadly in that moment.
Throughout the 2000s, companies started getting rid of poison pills. According to the website DealPoint Data, as of this morning, less than 2% of U.S. publicly traded companies have an active poison pill in place, but a majority likely have one on the shelf, in case an Elon Musk shows a little too much interest. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
China will come out with its first quarter growth numbers on Monday. And as we pointed out in the wrap, the world's second largest economy, it is going through a lot right now, especially with the country's current zero COVID policy. Depending on how you calculate it, up to 87 cities in China have at least some kind of COVID restriction. And the biggest one is in the financial capital, in Shanghai, a city with 25 million people that accounts for 4% of China's GDP. Our Shanghai correspondent Jennifer Pak has this update on the country's economy.
For one manufacturer of nuts and bolts in eastern China, 2022 started off with far fewer business inquiries. A third of the customers for Jinan Star Fastener Company are in the U.S. Zhang Yuhua is the sales director.
The situation won't be very good this year. So if we can keep the same level of sales as last year, then it's not bad.
Even this very modest expectation might be tough to meet, says Hang Seng Bank's chief economist Wang Dan.
The quarter one economic figures will be very dire.
Dire because of the war in Ukraine and the pandemic. First, the war. Initially, says Wang Dan, people thought it might be painful, but brief. It's been anything but.
Already, a number of factories along China's coast have suspended at least a part of their production lines because the raw material prices are increasing so rapidly.
Add on the global pandemic, and supply chains have been messy and expensive, according to shoemaker Ian White in San Diego. Most of his shoes are manufactured in China and exported to the U.S.
Whereas a 40-foot container from door to door used to take 28 days, and cost us about $3,500. Now can cost us anything from $12,000 to $15,000 and take 2 months to 2.5 months.
And the reasons vary, he says, whether there are delays because there aren't enough dock workers in the U.S. to unload.
Whether it be COVID in China and closing the port down.
One Chinese port city that has been relatively open these past 2 years, Shanghai. But that's changed during the latest surge of coronavirus infections. The Shanghai port is officially open for business, but in practice, it's a different story, says Kathy. She works with the Japanese underwear manufacturer that didn't authorize her to speak for this interview.
The trucks with the containers are not allowed to enter or leave from Shanghai.
And that means her customers could miss out on a whole season of clothing. And that's just the impact from the first 4 days of a partial lockdown in Shanghai. Again, economist Wang Dan.
At least in the first quarter, we're probably looking at a negative GDP growth rate. And in the second quarter, I would be very surprised if it's more than 2%.
The biggest unknown, she says, is how long it will take for Shanghai to lift the lockdown. And also other cities. But Beijing's leaders seem set to maintain zero tolerance for COVID. That means consistent mass testing, even for cargo at the Shanghai port. Again, underwear manufacturer Kathy.
Even the goods should be checked by a hospital, I've heard. So I was very surprised about that. So every day we pay extra at least about 3,000 yuan.
That's an extra $470 per delivery to check her goods for COVID.
It's very difficult for me to describe this to our customers in other countries because they cannot believe why the goods should get checked.
Especially when many other countries are opting to live with the virus and open their economies. In Shanghai under lockdown, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up,
going through 12 diapers a day.
Ugh, that is rough. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets are actually closed today for Good Friday. But for the week, the Dow Jones fell 0.8%. The Nasdaq lost 2.6%. And the S&P 500 dropped 2.1%. This weekend also marks the beginning of a holiday weekend, or week for many Americans. Passover, Easter, and Ramadan all overlapping this year. Travel bookings have also been creeping up. A little over 2,337,000 people passed through TSA checkpoints yesterday. That's just over 750,000 more than traveled on the day before Good Friday last year. You're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. So whenever I read or consume anything about fast fashion these days, there's a buzzword I keep coming across, and that is sustainability. Customers want it. Retailers claim they do too. And it has been a growing trend in the industry. Now, it's not totally clear whether it's genuinely reducing carbon footprint. But in any case, major brands like Target and Lululemon are committing to becoming more sustainable by expanding their resale presence. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab takes a look.
Let's do some inventory. How many items in your closet have tags on them? I'll go first.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, gosh. Okay, but in my defense, some of them are items I bought for summer and it's not warm enough to wear them yet.
Not an excuse for an ill-fitting dress I ordered on final sale. In fact, 9 billion pieces of hardly worn clothing are sitting in Americans' closets, according to ThredUp. Sucharita Kadali is a retail analyst with Forrester.
We just buy too much.
And we're not always good at returns. There's also resale value in items that go viral, like Lululemon's Define jacket. The youths on TikTok call it the BBL jacket, which stands for Brazilian butt lift. Videos of women wearing it have more than 5.5 million views.
Lulu's Define jacket really said Define.
The best-selling brands on Poshmark are, like, not super high-end, but they may have, like, a collectible element to them.
Kadali at Forrester says covetability has value. It's why luxury bags, watches, and jewelry are a staple in this space. There's also value at the opposite end of the spectrum. Garage sales and Goodwill have been around for a long time. That's where Target resale fits in.
You know, I imagine in an inflationary environment, it may be more cost-effective.
Cost-effective for people like Viviana Rivera, who's 30 and lives in San Diego. Everything she's currently wearing is secondhand, except her slippers.
I do have a line, so I don't shop for shoes. They have to be like brand new. Undergarments, I don't buy. Exercise clothes.
She says she probably wouldn't buy a used Lululemon sports bra, even at a good price. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
I don't know. I feel like I would if for the right price. All right, now on to supply chains. Yes, they are still congested, still causing headaches. But that said, we have been getting some signs in recent weeks that they're starting to ease up a bit. Like there's that big decline in the number of ships waiting to get into the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles. And analysts from Cass Information Systems say that in March, freight volumes eased up a bit. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more.
Ever since China started locking down ports and manufacturing hubs last month, the country hasn't been shipping as many products to the U.S.
That has drastically impacted the trucking capacity needs on the west coast of the United States.
Weston Labar is head of strategy at the freight broker Cargomatic.
Because you're not getting the constant flow of goods the way you were.
There are also more trucking companies than there were a year and a half ago, says Jason Miller, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State University.
We've had supply essentially starting to catch back up to where we need it to be.
But it depends on what type of trucking we're talking about. Miller says capacity is mostly freeing up when it comes to plain old unrefrigerated trucks that carry things like clothing, furniture, and appliances. But for flatbed trucking, which hauls big items like steel coils and heavy equipment, not so much.
Right now, we're seeing flatbed demand is very strong due to demand for machinery, demand for construction.
Even where capacity is freeing up, trucking prices are still pretty high.
I'm probably paying double a pallet versus a year and a half ago.
Pat Whalen handles imports for Sahadi's, a grocery store and wholesaler in Brooklyn. While he's paying more, he says he doesn't feel as much friction in the supply chain.
I'm not saying it's phenomenal. I'm not saying it's anywhere near where it used to be. You're still having a lot of challenges, but it's not the challenges you had, say, fourth quarter.
Even though things are improving, Whalen says he's still keeping a lot of extra product on hand just in case. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
So I host a podcast here at Marketplace called This is Uncomfortable. It is a storytelling show that explores our relationship with money. And the first story we ever did for the podcast was about a couple, Nika Geiger and Terrence McPherson. I talked with them back in 2019 about their love story and how money complicated their relationship. Back then, Terrence was debt-free, but Nika had more than $100,000 in student debt. And at first, she didn't really want to talk about it. It was hard for her to open up. And without spoiling the story too much, the two eventually do talk about her debt, and Terrence, right after getting engaged, makes this big gesture. He offers to put down $20,000 toward Nika's student debt. That, of course, was a few years ago, but I caught up with them the other day via Zoom. The full video, by the way, is on Marketplace's Instagram account. Now they are married, have a house, and there's another big development.
In stature, it's a small development, but we now have a child, Andre. He is actually, as of today, a month old. So we're really excited to have him. He's an angel in the day and a little terror at night, but we love every minute of it. He's a great kid.
Yes. Aww. We're proud of ourselves for keeping him alive for a month. So
it's great. An achievement. Well, I remember when we talked, y'all, you know, you were talking about kids, how it could change financial calculations naturally. So how's that going? How has having a baby changed how you think about your financial life?
Yeah, I mean, we had lots of conversation around it when, you know, we made the decision. Our Amazon bill has gone way up.
Yeah.
Just Pampers alone, we've spent a lot more money on. So right now we have a lump sum that's in our budget that we're kind of estimating it might be. But, you know, we know it could be higher or lower since we're brand new to this. Yeah.
Well, I remember y'all were really good about budgeting. You shared how you all have a bit of a ritual around it, right? You create a kind of date night around looking at your finances sometimes because you have this pretty comprehensive spreadsheet where you all like sit down. I remember you said that you like have mood lighting sometimes, put on some Toni Braxton and go over, you know, make a night out of it and go over your finances. Are y'all still doing that?
Yeah, we largely still do. But now we still have spreadsheets with different scenarios, and they've gotten a little bit more complex, especially based on where we are in our lives. Andre, as you can imagine, has a number of expenses we didn't know a baby would have, like going through 12 diapers a day. But also just with the effects of the pandemic. Now we're not considering as much childcare as an option. So now we're looking at opportunities where maybe our families will come in. We want to even build an addition on the house. So we have an additional room for somebody to be able to take care of him while we work during the day. The ritual in and of itself still largely applies. Unfortunately, the alcohol has had to go, but we're still keep making it fun.
So I remember when we talked, you know, big theme in the episode was your student debt, Nika. So that was a few years ago. I'm curious how that's going now.
Yeah. So the latest is the pandemic had like a big impact on that. So we decided to pause since the interest was paused and see how much we could save up. It allowed us to save for, you know, the down payment on the house and to furnish the house. So as of now, we haven't been paying since it's been suspended. But in the last few months, we have been contributing a line item in the budget to kind of put to the side. So if the time comes, you know, we'll be a lot closer to putting a lump sum on it and, you know, nearly eliminate it. You know, if it comes, I'm still holding out hope that it'll get eliminated. But if not, then, you know, we'll be able to put, you know, pay that way down.
Yeah. You all obviously have great communication. You figured out so much around your finances together. What advice would you give to couples when it comes to finances and how to talk about it?
I would say pay attention to your triggers and understand what's causing them. One example was about the student loans when they were on pause. Nika was very comfortable, like, okay, we just don't have to pay these for a while. We're good. But to me, since I never really had student loans, that became like a psychological burden. And so peeling back the layers of not really having debt, I started to get more comfortable with it and come with a more rational way of how we look at our debt. Recognizing that you're being triggered and understanding why and having that conversation with your partner or whoever else is an important part of your circle is critical.
That's so real. Because yeah, usually the money is not really about the money, right? Like your anxieties around it can be about
Exactly. It represents, it's a totem. It represents something else.
That was Nika and Terrence McPherson. This final note on the way out today, brace yourselves, it is a controversial one. Are you a fan of Peeps or are you a hater? According to the e-commerce platform Pattern, the colorful, gooey marshmallow sugar candy goodness that is Peeps is the most popular candy in the run-up to Easter, at least among the candy brands that are sold on Amazon. But I can personally attest that they are, in fact, the best. All right, we gotta go. No moment of economic context today. You're gonna have to find your own again. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fregali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Rima Khreis. Have a good weekend, y'all. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.